everybody. Welcome to a special Hot Box, and I'm Evan Britton.
And I'm Mike Tyson.
And Mike, we've got a really awesome guest here today.
Yeah, this is cool. I always watch his show. I watched it with Jay-Z, and that was really interesting.
Yeah, he's
now
the man.
Now we have him. This is so cool.
He's
I don't
really
know how this happened.
One of my favorite guys from CNN, Van Jones. Welcome to the podcast, my brother.
Awesome. I thought you'd be big for us and stuff.
Come on. No,
I know.
This is the hottest podcast in the history of the podcast. I'm glad to get in early. I'm glad I got in early.
I love it, man. Well, just to further introduce you, you are the CEO of the Reform Alliance. The Reform Alliance is committed to advancing criminal justice reform and eradicating laws and policies that perpetuate injustice in the U.S. To achieve that objective, the Reform Alliance will strive to pass probation bills at the state level, use media to amplify the need for comprehensive reform, and build an inclusive bipartisan alliance of leaders from business, entertainment, sports, and community industries who share a cohesive vision for ambitiously and efficiently transforming the criminal justice system.
That's it.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, this is something I've been focusing on for about 25 years. I graduated from Yale Law School in 1993. And the year before that was Rodney King, 92.
Wow.
And the year after that was the 94 Clinton crime bill. And so I'm a 24-year-old black 24-year-old black kid with a Yale law degree and dreadlocks down my back. And I was like, I feel like I'm under the target. I feel like I feel like police brutality and this prison thing is aimed at me. And both political parties were in favor of building more prisons. It was a Bill Clinton crime bill. California passed three strikes and you're out. California, blue California, built 20 prisons and only one university over the course of about 25 years.
Because somebody was getting paid.
Exactly.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
Yeah, and so I was like, look, we're the bait. I mean, we're just going to be, you know, the grist in the mill. I want to fight back. So I used my law degree in Oakland to try to fight back. And I had to fight Democrats and Republicans because both parties were against us. And now finally, 25 years later, both parties are coming around. And you got people like, you know, Jay-Z and Robert Smith and Meek Mill, all these, you know, big people coming around. And I said, I wanted to put my 25 years to use.
Well, I think you're right on time, man.
Yeah, man. It's crazy.
It is crazy. So take me back, because as you say, you've been an activist for criminal justice reform for a long time. In Oakland, you co-founded the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights.
Who's Ella Baker?
Ella Baker is one of the great unsung civil rights heroines. You know, she, when Dr. King was a young, you know, guy coming on the scene, created the SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, he hired her to run it because she was a brilliant organizer. She'd been the NAACP. She'd been labor. She was a genius for organizing. But these young black preachers was like, you know, she's like the black grandma. Just, you know, do what we say. She said, what? So she quit working for Dr. King. And that later that year, the students started sitting in spontaneously. And she said, they need organization. She said, I'm going to build a movement. I want to have leaders that are movement-centered leaders. I don't want a leader-centered movement. She said, Dr. King's trying to build a leader-centered movement. I want movement-centered leaders. So she interposed herself between the students and Dr. King. She said, Dr. King, you need to do what you're doing. I'm going to help these students. So the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that did all that voter registration, all sort of stuff, those were her young people. Nobody knows her name. So I wanted to give her some credit. Because a lot of times black women are the secret sauce that never get the name on the label. So we made the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights.
Mm. You guys did a lot of super important work there. Tell me about Maurice Hudson.
Yeah, you know, just recently in Philadelphia, you know, of course, Meek Mill, you know, he got sent to prison, supposed to be for 4 years. Luckily, we got him out because he was on probation and he popped a wheelie. That's it. I mean, it's not like he didn't like shoot nobody. He didn't rob a bank. He just was on probation, popped a wheelie, put it on Instagram, boom, 4 years in prison. So that started a whole fight in Philadelphia that probation is being abused, probation is being misused, people are going back to prison for non-crimes. It's a spider's web of cash.
Oh, man, I had a probation. I had this redneck probation in Ohio. I couldn't hang around Tupac or Bobby Brown. Stay away. You're violated.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, so going back to your day.
Telling you who you can hang out with.
Yeah, this is my best friend. This is my partner at the time.
Yeah.
I can't hang out with Bobby Brown or Tupac. Violation right away. That's a violation. It would be anywhere around them.
And, wow. I mean, that's, I mean, and if they're telling you that, you know, what are they telling Pookie and Snoopy and Shanaynay on the street corner? I mean, like, you can't be with your cousin. You can't be.
The reality of that is total control. Like, when he did that, Willie, it disgusted somebody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How dare that piece of dirt do that?
Yeah.
They sure don't know their place since Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to say it like that, but that's just how they looked at it. It's just, it's a shame that I have to say that people, it's a shame that I know how they think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know what I mean? It goes back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a form of self-hate. The fact that I know the way that someone thinks about me and I think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it poisons your brain. But Maurice, the same judge that gave Meek Mill those 2 to 4 years for popping a wheelie, also grabbed this, you know, lesser-known person named Maurice.
He's a janitor.
Yeah, he's a janitor. He had 2 kids, you know, special needs kids.
Right.
He's with the baby's mom. He's going to work every day. But, you know, those fees and fines pile up, and you have to try to pay them off. Well, he got $1,914 of unpaid fines.
Yeah.
She gave him 2 years in prison for being too poor to pay $1,900.
It's insane.
And so, and it was the same judge, Judge Brinkley, the same terrible judge. So Meek Mill jumped in, Michael Rubin from 76ers jumped in, and we got him out. But it just goes to show, you have bad judges, but you also have bad laws.
Yeah.
If you can change the laws, the judges can't do anything. But as long as you leave those bad laws on the book, a bad judge will find that bad law and abuse it. So we're now in Pennsylvania trying to change the law. Mm-hmm. So we've got a bill called 1555 in the House, bipartisan. We've got Representative Harris and Representative DeLozier. He's black. She's white. He's a Democrat. She's a Republican. But they're working together to try and change some of these unjust probation laws so people don't – listen, if you're on probation or parole and you're out there committing new crimes, that's different.
Right.
But if you're just talking to your homeboy or you're 15 minutes late for a probation meeting or your aunt is sick and you go to check on her in the so-called wrong neighborhood, you're not selling drugs over there. You're just checking on your – you shouldn't go to prison. People don't understand – you send somebody to prison. Oh, you're just going to send you for 3 months.
Right.
Well, hold on a second. 3 months. 3 months. Lock the door here and for 3 months and see how you feel. And you had an apartment. 3 months later, that apartment is gone. You had a little job. 3 months later, that job is gone. Your children, 3 months later, they're in foster care.
So why do you think that is?
I think it's because the whole way that the prison industrial complex, mass incarceration is built off of poor people, black people, and brown people that nobody cares about. I went to Yale. I saw more kids doing drugs at Yale than I ever saw doing drugs in a housing project. But none of them went to prison. Nobody even called the police. If they got caught, they went to rehab.
Right.
They didn't go to prison. The cop cars would drive past Yale with the lights flashing, past Skull and Bones, past all these people doing these drugs to go to the housing project. And put them in prison for a little bit of
or
worse. And so you can't tell me, I'm hard to fool. You can't tell me that we don't know what to do with young people involved with drugs. Because if you're rich, you go to rehab or Europe and you come back and your life is fine. If you're poor, black or brown, you go to prison. So we got all these nonviolent drug offenders that nobody wants to hire. But hold on a second. Show me the person who's not a nonviolent drug offender. Most people, I can say I've never been one, but most people at some point in their life, 17, 18, 24, last weekend, were nonviolent drug offenders. But they're in society, they're at the country club, they're at the yacht club, they're golfing, so they're okay. Mm. But they won't hire you because you are not, because all I'm saying is that you ask why. I think because we have dehumanized.
I was just going to say that. I was saying, listen, I was reading, I was looking at a slave documentary. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really slave. It was a black documentary about black people. And it showed during slave period how they wrote so eloquently, so nicely, how useful the slave is, and the blacks were so strong and useful in the mate. And then soon the slave and Reconstruction, they talked about how lazy they were. And so they changed. Mm-hmm. They kept that perspective on the world. And everybody, when we expect to see a black man shot in the street. This is normal to us. It's not shocking. It's not resounding. Whoa, seeing that. No, this is what we're supposed to see. A nigga get beat, a black woman get shot in the face, or some cop beating this black woman. We're not supposed to get shocked at that. That's why we show it every day. See, even yourself, you see it so much, you almost become numb to it. You expect that to happen. When it becomes shocking, then it becomes where people care.
I remember when, you know, back during the when Black Lives Matter first jumped off in 2013, and they would show the videos, and everybody would go crazy and stuff like that. Now, when I'm looking on my Instagram, if I see one of those videos, I almost go past it because it's just I've seen it too many times. It's like it's just too hard, and you don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I know if I feel that way, a lot of people feel that way. It's become desensitizing, and so we begin to participate. In the normalization,
even
of
though we march, but that's what we're accustomed to. They killed another black person. They raped another black. We're accustomed to that.
Yeah.
You know, that's just what we're accustomed to in the black community.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the positive part is that people at least are starting to realize that, you know, this incarceration industry is what I call it, the incarceration industry, trafficking in human bodies.
Yeah. So what do you do? So once we get them out of prison, but do we keep them off parole then? Probation? How do you work that system? How do you do when a guy's already spent 20 years in jail? How do you civilize him?
Well, I mean, you got to civilize society first, so we don't put people in prison for that long for minor stuff. And
I know, but listen, that's going to be
that may take a minute.
Lifetime. But when they can get out now. But when they get out now, now we have uncivilized people. In the community.
Think, Mike?
Excuse me?
What do you think?
I think, I don't know. It doesn't matter what I think, but my way of thinking, if I ran a civilization, that people that come out of prison have to be in a program to get civilized in society. They can't just throw them out in society.
You can't just throw them back in
the streets. Guy that's been in prison 20 years fighting for his ass, stabbing and cutting people, and sometimes getting fucked, but next thing he's still fighting, and now he's a savage, now you got to throw him in society. Mm-hmm. And somebody may talk to him a certain way, and then he flips, he blows up.
Luckily, you know, we passed the First Step Act last year, and 7,000 people have come home. There was one who did wrong, and actually wound up, now he's being charged with having killed somebody. So you're correct, that does happen. But there are 6,999 who did come home and who have done a good job. So I think a lot of it has to do with. When people are in prison, what are we doing? And a lot
that one person sent the big impact.
Yeah, that's agree.
The bigger impact than 699 that did good.
Yeah, so we have to make sure to tell the stories and lift up the stories of the ones who are doing well. Also, one of the most powerful things is more people are going behind the bars now to do literacy programs, to talk to women who are mothers behind bars, or whatever. And when they get behind there, they're like, "What the hell? Are we spending taxpayer money creating this much pain and suffering?" And that's starting to have an impact.
But how do you stop them from being at, what's the word I'm looking for? Stereotype to that pain, suffer, addicted to it. Mm-hmm. I'm addicted to prison.
Trained in it.
You know, I remember when I used to get locked up. I first got locked up in Spofford. I'm 12 years old. And I'm scared to death because I hear what they do to people in Spofford. But I'm on the streets with all those kids, the wild kids. I'm on the street. I'm a ghetto kid. I've never been arrested. I've been arrested, but I've never been locked up before. And so I'm scared. I'm going up there. I hear about they rape and they stab people up and they do up there. I'm scared to death. As soon as I get in there and they bring me to the, it was chow time for breakfast. They bring me in and it's, "Dirty Mike, yo, dirty." All my friends was in there.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I'm not worried. I got 200 guys right here. All my friends, all guys from Manhattan, guys from Brooklyn, people that we know on the streets from robbing and hustling. And they run the place. Matter of fact, I don't want to go home no more. I want to stay here.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Why?
Because all my comrades are here. This is my family. I got to go home in a stinking apartment of fucking rats and roaches. No food. Fuck, that three hots in a car fighting, stabbing. Oh, this is what I live for. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go back home to nothing. If I go back home, I'll go get some money and get back in here.
Wow. Well, you know, for me...
imagine that for 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, I'm a...
That's one day.
Yes,
I one see day. My friend and it's home. Yeah. I'm happy. Then I am when I'm home. I'm happy here. They're going to stab somebody. They're going to fight for me. I don't got to worry about nobody hurting me. This is home.
Mike, we got a big fight coming up here, brother.
Oh, yes, we do. This, I think I would like the whole Tyson Ranch to go there. We should get tickets for the whole Tyson Ranch.
For the Fury Wilder fight?
Yeah, I would love to do that.
Dude, it's fucking dope. Also, John Bones Jones versus Dominic Reyes.
Hey, this guy Reyes, you know, he's really talking some shit like he wants to win.
Fuck, dude. A guy with a nickname Bones, John Bones Jones, I don't know if I want to fuck with that guy.
When a guy got that reputation, somebody wants it.
Yeah, yeah. You want to go fucking take it.
The team got that reputation. Yeah, I want those team. I want to steal. I want to see how good they really are.
Yeah. It's like David versus Goliath.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. The underdog coming in and taking the championship. Were you ever an underdog?
Never in my life.
Yeah.
I was always Goliath. Only in life I was underdog.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. What do you think Tyson Fury's best attribute is? If Wilder's is how hard he hits, what's Tyson Fury's? That he's undead?
No, that he's just his confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. He believes in himself more than anything else.
Yeah. Confidence sky high.
Yeah.
Especially after getting up from the punch. Now, imagine how bad. Imagine what he think he is now after getting up after all that adversity.
Yeah, I know. Coming back. So, look, guys, you can bet on all this shit. You could gamble on literally anything, any competition happening. Just head over and visit our good friends and exclusive partner at Podcast One, Bet Online, to take advantage of the best bonuses in the business. Sign up for a free account and make sure to use that promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% sign-up bonus.
All right. Once again, visit BetOnline and don't forget the promo code, okay? PODCAST1 for your 50% sign-up bonus. BetOnline, your online sportsbook expert.
Don't you think time is such a fascinating thing?
Know why I believe it's fascinating? Even because that's the only thing on this planet that we don't have much of.
Mm.
And we can't get much of it. Mm. We can't get it back. We can get money back. We can get revenge, but we can't get the time back. It's the only thing that we use, the word I want to say.
Frivolously.
Yeah, frivolously.
Yeah.
We take time for granted.
We do. Well, speaking of time. Finding a high-quality, good-looking watch without breaking the bank is no easy task, Mike. I know you've had some nice watches in your day.
Ooh, I had some of the best. Yeah, I had some really good watches.
Well, these watches are dope as hell. It's our newest sponsor, Vincero Watches.
Vincero?
Yes, sir. Vincero creates exceptionally crafted watches, and they do it without costing you an arm and a leg.
These watches are really fly, and they make you feel unstoppable.
Mike, can I tell you, my rookie year, one of my first purchases, I bought myself like a $14,000 Breitling.
Really?
And dude, you know what? It fucking, I have to say, it was not the best money I've ever spent. You know,
I spend $400,000 on watches. Jesus. I spend millions on watches. And I don't know where they are.
Right, exactly, dude. They're gone. That Breitling's gone.
Where they at? Who fucking stole my watch?
Go. See ya.
Woo, baby,
dude. So, Mike, I'm telling you, man, these watches are awesome. I'm wearing the Rogue model in black and rose gold.
It looks
right
stunning,
now.
And absolutely stunning. I have to tell you, man, it's stunning.
I'll admit, I'm feeling pretty fresh, brother.
Listen, man, fresh is an understatement.
Thank you.
That is really stunning.
Well, you also inspired me with the turtlenecks.
Well, thank you. I like turtlenecks. It's hard to find a good turtleneck.
Oh, my wife got me two of them for Christmas. I feel fly as fuck.
I love turtlenecks.
Yes. Well, Mike, tell our listeners, since they're listening to this podcast, what they get.
Because you're listening to this podcast, they're offering you loyal hot boxing listeners a great discount.
That's right. So head over to VinceroWatches.com. That's Vincero, V-I-N-C-E-R-O, spelled like Vincero, pronounced like Vincero. Go to the website and use discount code Tyson.
This deal is too good to pass up. Use my code Tyson for your discount, and you'll get it.
That's it, baby. Vincero.
Vincero. Vincero.
You know, our lives are so different because, you know, I grew up in the rural South. My father was born in 1944, so segregation and poverty, basically what you would call a shotgun shack. They didn't call it a shack, but it was a shotgun house where each room is behind the next room, so you could fire a shotgun through the front door and hit everybody in the house. So that's how narrow the little property was that they had. And he joined the military to get out of poverty. Put himself through college, put his little brother through college, put a cousin through college, married the college president's daughter, my mother, because my dad had it like that. He knew what he was doing. And so I was a total nerd. Like he would open up the refrigerator door. Like if I complained about anything, he's like, "Do you see this refrigerator? There's always been food in this refrigerator. There's always been food. What are you talking about?" I'm like, "That's not that impressive to me, sir." You know, he's like, "Pia!" You know, it's like, so I missed that whole experience, and I wind up, when my father died, they put the picture they put of him on the funeral program was him standing in front of Yale Law School with his fist in the air. You know, we did it, you know. And so I'm like one generation removed from all the stuff that he went through. But I was sitting listening to his, you know, him and my uncles and that sort of stuff, talking about that stuff. I mean, for me, I feel guilty. I almost feel, as a black man, like I just have like survivor's guilt. I'm like, why me? Mm. So many guys that were smarter than me.
Listen, I say the same thing all the time to my wife. I say, smarter than me, got more power than me, more money than me, has a bigger family connection, everybody respect them. You know what I mean? And they didn't make it.
Right.
And I always say it's divinely guided. Mm. You know what I mean? We can't explain it, but we know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We know we're different.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just a weird feeling, you know. I go into prisons a lot, just because I'm a lawyer. I'm trying to help people, and I just see all these brothers, and they're brilliant, strong, better looking. You know what I mean? Like everything, they have everything over me. I mean, if I had to compete with these guys, I would be their intern. You know what I mean? I'd have to work for these guys, but they've swept up all these black men and put them all out of competition. So then I go in there and I come home and I'm like, I mean, I just feel, that's why I fight so hard. Because I'm like, these guys deserve a shot. If these guys had a shot, they'd be running everything because they're that strong, they're that smart.
Oh, wow, you don't believe it either. This is interesting.
Well,
you're pretty smart. Listen, you have nothing to do with that. You know, this is survival of the fittest. They look better than us. They perform better than us. And all due praise be to Allah, but they're not. It's an illusion. We're the survivors, we're the strongest, the survivors of the fittest. And if you don't look at it like that, you're strongly mistaken. You think you went to all those schools by accident? You know what I mean? You were designed to do that. Your father went to, you think that was by accident? All designed to do that. My mother was, my father was, they were street workers. They had me. Yeah, my brother's a doctor too, in emergency in LA, right? But listen up. They're street people. And they had me, probably because they were horny. And look where I've been all over the world. Look all the people I've touched.
Crazy.
And touched me. Mm-hmm. And it's just not by accident. Because I had a low self-esteem, but still I'm a megalomaniac. I think I'm so special, you know? But no one can say the things that I say about myself. Like I may say I'm a piece of shit, someone else say that, it's a fight right away. Because I don't think that, but sometimes I think I need to be checked because my head is too big, and I think too much of myself. And I don't think nobody could check me but me.
Yeah, I watched the... You know, there's a couple of documentaries about you, which you know, I have on my laptop. When I want to be inspired or challenged or whatever, I'll watch. You know,
really?
Yeah, man. The things that you've said, the things that you've done, you know, Cus D'Amato and how, like, you know, you met Muhammad Ali when you were a kid, like all these different things.
Yeah, I was in the reform school.
I know your whole thing. I mean, but, you know, as a black man watching the things that you've done, the things that you've been through, your ups and your downs, you know, your good decisions, your bad decisions, or whatever. It does provide a roadmap because, I mean, your everything you do is so extreme. I mean, it's just like the king, like the biggest champion ever, like knocking people out or whatever, and then like, you know, having all these problems. And so you can learn from your whole arc. But I think, you know, for me, I was just a nerd. I didn't get any trouble because my dad, I was just like scared of my dad. I don't know what to do at this point. I'm 51. I work for President Obama. I work for Prince. I was a grassroots outsider, young radical militant. Then I became a White House insider, targeted by the media, right-wing media. Now I'm a part of the media. You know, I went to public schools in the rural South. I went to a fancy Ivy League school. I've kind of done 360. So I'm part of the fool. I've seen all these different points and parts. But after that, I mean, you don't know what to do. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you figured out how to do something, you know, this podcast, whatever. But you can go through so many things in life.
Oh, man.
That you don't really know
you
what
know
to
what
do
to
next.
Do, man.
You don't know what you do. I don't know if you do it that way, but maybe you can get on your knees. You can do it right. And you can show gratitude and thank God for all the blessings that you got. Yeah. Thank Him for your beautiful eyesight, your hands, your feet, your touch, your beautiful children, your experience in life.
Gratitude.
That triples your blessings. I was such a selfish, self-centered person, and I'm still that way. But this time, but I'm just very grateful, and I have a lot of gratitude.
But I saw you with your wife, and that was amazing. You like y'all like you like touching her hand and like doing all super sweet
hey,
stuff.
Because my wife is I know I wouldn't even say my rock. My wife is my solar system. Without my wife, I'm a savage. I don't have no respect for women or nobody. Hmm. Yeah, my wife makes me makes me know that I'm a man. It makes me remember I'm a man and I'm not an animal.
How?
Excuse me?
How does she do that?
Just her existence, the nearness of her. Just the nearness of her. It's being close to her.
Now, I saw that. That was crazy. Like, you know, there's these little tiny gestures. Like nothing's really going on. All of a sudden, I look over and you like just like touched her hand, or you like leaned over toward her, whatever. Just put your head on her shoulder. I'm like, this is like the most fearsome.
No, it's just that, you know, I knew my wife and I've been married for 10 years. I know my wife since she was 18. Yeah, and so we have an interesting relationship. And during my relationship, I've heard her many times, and. I just don't want to do that anymore. Hmm. You know, I don't know. I don't want to say enlightened, but I've learned a few things over the years. Yeah. And I don't want to be the cause of her pain anymore.
Yeah, God is good.
No, he's good when it looks bad, too. He's always good. He's even good when it looks bad.
Yeah, it's awesome. It is awesome. It's been awesome to be here with you, Mike.
Awesome to be with you, man.
You know? To watch your growth and your evolution over the last couple of years. It's amazing, dude.
I just learned, I know human beings are not meant to be humble. They're meant to be humbled. You know, we have to learn to be humble.
Mm.
You know, because we have to know that, you know, sometimes when we look at ants, me and my wife, one day we were watching my son play his baseball game, and we're sitting down, I said, babe, look at these ants, and all these ants are, and it's about the time of the season where they die. Mm. So, by now, they've done everything within the summer. They've done everything within 2 months, whatever summer is, than we can do in a lifetime. Mm. Right? And then I said, you know that, baby? And I said, I wonder this. Just like we're watching them, I wonder who's watching us. Mm. So I think somebody has to be watching us like we're watching these ants, because we're great, but we're not that significant. Yes, say if all those ants died, the world would die. Mm. If all the birds, if all the trees died, the world would die. Yeah. If all of us died, the world would flourish.
Yeah.
So we're not that hot shit.
Wow. That's dope.
You know, we're not really hot shit. Egos, I look at my ego and I wish I could shoot myself in the head sometimes. I think so many great things and I'm a god and all this shit. And then I have to go and take my son to baseball game.
Yeah.
Yeah, get your dude. Chores on.
Yeah. Go to the gym and ride the bike.
Yeah.
Shit.
No shit.
Oh, shit. Awesome.
Well, Vin, you've got I mean, you know, man, I think you're right on your destiny path.
What can we do to help you in
you're
this?
Doing. This is important work you're doing, man.
I appreciate that.
And you have cultivated a very significant presence in the media. Mm. I believe that. And I think that the work you're doing right now is invaluable. Mm. And, you know, I think you know exactly what you're doing, dude. You know?
Well, I tell you, I'm getting closer to God again. Mm. You know, part of what I think happened, you know, when you're an African-American man, you're a Democrat, and you decide you're going to work with Donald Trump.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah, to pass the bill. You go through a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because I felt like we were in a, you know, a dilemma, you know, a no-win situation. Either we just, because the Republicans started to move in a better direction on criminal justice, you know, Rick Perry in Texas.
Weirdly.
Yeah, but listen, from their point of view, not from our point of view, but from their point of view, they don't want to see a big failed government bureaucracy eating up taxpayer money, making stuff worse.
Sure.
Some of them are Christians. They don't want to, you know, see no redemption. Some of them are libertarians. They don't want to see liberties being – so they not for our racial justice, but for their own reasons.
Sure.
They had come around. And then Trump comes in, and Trump is like law and order and, you know, and was pushing the Republicans in the wrong direction again. And I had to make a decision. Democrats aren't as courageous when they feel like the Republicans are going to come after them and call them soft on crime and that kind of thing. Mm. And so the key to Democrats being strong is Republicans being strong. The key to Republicans being strong is Trump being strong. So if I want, I got to go deal with Trump.
Yeah.
And, or I could just say, well, I cared about black people under every other president. I cared about people in prison under Obama. I was in the White House every week under Obama begging, let people out. We got to have criminal justice. And now this new president comes in, I'm nowhere to be found.
Right.
So did I really care? Mm. Or was it ego? Was it career? So I got to go in there and I got to deal with the guy. And, you know, frankly, he shocked a lot of people. He signed a bill that's led out a bunch of people. He's done way more than people thought. But, man, that was a tough process because, you know, people say, well, you're giving him a win. You're giving Trump a victory. Blah, 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 blah. I'm like, well, but it's a dilemma.
Right.
If I can keep deny him a victory, but I'm also going to deny all these people in prison a victory.
Yeah.
I can give these people in prison a victory, but I'm giving them a victory. Well, I would rather for the people who I know don't have a voice to be able to come home and see their kids. They don't care who's in the White House. They want to come home to their mama's house. But man, I went through a lot. People that I respect and love say I was a sellout, an Uncle Tom, a coon, a traitor.
Listen, you tell me they're still talking like that in the 21st century?
Hey, listen, look at...
They're calling black people coons and...
Well, first of all, we didn't hear enough of this in the media. We didn't hear enough about this in the media.
About the victory?
Yes.
Yes, the First Step Act victory?
Yeah, the First Step Act.
Yeah, no, I mean, we think about it now. December 22nd, I believe it was, maybe December 21st, Trump signs the First Step Act, which the New York Times says is the most substantial breakthrough in criminal justice in a generation.
Yes.
It made it where women can't be shackled anymore in federal prisons when they're pregnant. It made it where people have to be held closer to their families. It made it where half people in federal prison can earn their way home sooner by doing a bunch of good stuff. Programs and stuff, 100% can come home sooner if they just stay out of trouble, and 7,000 people got a chance to come home. So that's a pretty big deal. If you're the liberal media, do you want to give Trump that big victory?
Right.
Probably
CNN's
not
going to show that shit.
You know, they showed it for a minute, but you know, then the next day, I think the government shut down. They're off to other issues. And if you're the conservatives, you know, you kind of like it, but you know.
Politics are like religion in a way.
Yeah. And so you wind up with this, with nobody knows what to do. It doesn't fit the narrative.
And that's why people don't want
to. Right.
That's why people don't want to be involved with religion. Because religion is like this. If you don't have the ideology that we have, or won't change our ideology, you're going to hell. Mm-hmm. That's basically all religion, the Christian, Muslim. That's all religion. If you don't follow us, you're pretty much.
Then you're wrong.
You're wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, it wound up being...
And so politics are like that, too. If you don't go with this way, you're wrong.
Yeah. But I tell you what, now I'm a lot closer to God.
Well, that happens when you get in your 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you're close to your mortality. You know, there's any moment, you know, That's like when we did the total. You know, it's just it's going to be over soon. Not it's a possibility we ain't going to see another 50
right.
or 20, 30. So it's, we have to prepare ourselves for death. We do it without even unconsciously. We prepare for our death. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's what happens. As soon as we're born, we start preparing for our death. Mm-hmm. First moment we're born, without unconsciously knowing, we start preparing for it.
Are you ready?
Huh?
Do you feel ready?
Absolutely. I think I was born. I think I was living too long.
I don't think anybody agrees with that. Why do you say that?
It's just what are we here for? That's our purpose. You know, our purpose is to die and go to another place. And sometimes, and some of us in our difficulties in handling that stage of life, we kill ourselves before it's our time. Because it's frightening about dying, but sometimes the thought of living while thinking about dying is too much. Mm-hmm. So you say this. This is what I said at one stage. God made me. I wasn't doing anything. No one asked to be here. I was made, and now sooner or later, I got to worry about dying. And then as I got older, I realized life was glorious. The worst of life is glorious. And I said, death has to be glorious as well as life. Because the two, how could they not be? How could death not be glorious and life is glorious? Life is glorious if you're homeless or a beggar. Just inhale, life is nothing. It's nothing better.
Man, you're deeper than I know.
We go deep, man.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I look at my kids now, and I got a 15-year-old boy who's as tall as me, and wow. You know, super, like you were talking about, you know, how your kids are like really smart and doing all kind of good stuff. Like I got my older boy is like a 4.0 and taking physics and Mandarin, and he's like a soccer player and all that stuff.
So,
and you know, I watch him, he's living a totally different life than I lived when I was growing up. But I wasn't good in school and I wasn't a good athlete. So but I watch this guy and I'm like, you know, someday I'm not going to be here. And he's going to talk about who his dad was. Mm. You know, life just goes on.
Yep.
And, you know, hopefully, you know, he'll do well. And his little brother's 11. And hopefully he'll do well. But, yeah, it does, man. It's crazy. Also, I have nothing left to prove for myself in terms of to be able to walk into the Trump White House and come out with a victory for our people, even though it wasn't seen, even though it wasn't recognized, even though I was criticized. I know what we did.
Dude, that's so huge.
And
so huge.
You know, and so I don't, for me, I am thinking about what these next 5, 10, 20, 30 years are going to be. And I agree with you, you know, gratitude is important. But I just, I'm at a crossroads.
What are you grateful for right now?
Oh, right. Well, my kids.
Yeah.
My boys are, like, amazing. I mean, my little boy is emotional and difficult and creative, kind of like me. And then the big boy is, like, super, like, smart and pretty well-disciplined, especially for a teenager, like his mom. And so I get a chance to watch these, like, smaller versions of us, you know what I mean, going through the stuff that they go through. And I'm thinking, listen, man, I mean, to get a chance to work, the Reform Alliance is amazing. You know, I got to sit in rooms with, like, you know, billionaires who care about people behind bars.
That's great.
And you just, like, I mean, they're not half-stepping. They're not messing around. They're like, we got to do something. Most people don't know that there are people at high places that care.
Hey, you ever think about you?
What do you mean?
Why you do this? Why are you you?
Don't y'all have no commercial breaks? I don't have to sell nothing.
Really?
What do you mean?
You know, why do you do what you do?
Why are you interested in this?
Why do you care about motherfucking prison? Mm-hmm. That sold somebody some bad drugs that might died.
Yeah. You know, even when I was a child, I just had a lot of feelings and empathy. Like we lived in the country, gravel road. No, you know, we had like a septic tank. You know, and no street lights and stuff like that. So at night, you know, you could see everything because there's no street lights or whatever. But also, there's a lot of animals, and so you see death. You know, you're a little kid, you're looking out the window, and all of a sudden, it's like there's like a dead dog or a dead frog or a dead deer or whatever. It's like just smashed up on the side of the road. And my parents got to the point they wouldn't let me look out the window because I'd be crying for like a day over some like dog that I saw and, you know, why, whatever. So I was always been really sensitive and...
You're an empath.
Yeah. And so, and then, you know, my dad was tough, you know, and I wasn't. And so that was an issue in the house. He was afraid that I was gay or whatever he was afraid of. But, you know, he was this tough kid, grew up in the, you know, not even the hood, like really poor, and then was in the military. And so he's this big, tough, he had been a cop in the military and this type of thing. And I got this like little kid that cries all the time and like, you know.
Little nerd.
Yeah, a little nerd. So it was like an issue in the house. And so, I would read comic books and stuff, and I would read about these great heroes who would, you know, they were like a nerd, you know, like Clark Kent or Peter Parker, but then they would like, you know, become a hero. And I just think that imprinted on my brain that I wanted to go out and help people. I don't know why. There's no one thing that happened. I just knew from a very small age I wanted to help people. And also, suddenly I look up, I'm like 6'1", you know, almost 200 pounds. I was like this big, like, all through high school, even into college, like a little scarecrow with big glasses, you know, getting picked on. And then all of a sudden, I'm not. And I felt like I could do something. But people have asked me a lot of times, I don't have a good answer except to know that I hate bullies. I hate when somebody has power and abuses it. I hate to see anybody being mistreated. And it doesn't feel like a choice to me. It's just like almost like an automatic reaction trying to do something. And so I've just spent my whole life fighting for other people, maybe for my own glory and stuff. But at the same time, I know if I was just after the glory, I'd be a lot more famous. Like, I'm only just famous enough to be able to fight my fight. I don't want
it. That's what you think?
Yeah.
Is this all from your perception?
Yes, sir. What do you think?
I think you're more famous than you think you are.
Yeah.
Your ego's bigger than you think it is too, but I think you're more famous than you think you are. But you don't think you're that famous. That's really weird.
Well, I mean, I work with like Anderson Cooper and Jay-Z. Like, these guys are like legends. Like, they're drill level.
What did you just say? What did you just say? Say it again. What did you just say? Say what you just said again.
I said I work with legends.
Boom. That's it. You don't work with them unless you're their equal. They might not think that, but why are they talking to you? Why are you talking to them? Why are you talking to me? I'm real happy to be talking to you. I've seen you talk to all those big shots. So now, whatever insecurities I have, I don't have them no more because I talk to you too, just like those big shots did.
Yeah. Well, you're the biggest big shot.
But that's ooh, the most insecure people in the world, the most powerful ones. Remember that. They say whatever, you know. How could you not be insecure? Because if you're insecure in the position that you're in, you're in position to lose that position. We can never be secured in our position because there's always somebody gunning for it.
True.
So how can you be secured when somebody's gunning for you? That's not, you know, that's not a secure position to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like uneasy wears the head that, whatever the crown or whatever
where's
it is,
the crown
Shakespeare stuff.
Yeah, yeah, man. Yeah, y'all podcast is more difficult.
Hey, dude, it's all good.
Can we think about what? Who are we? What is our? Do you ever think about who's the first you? Whatever the first man, the oldest man is 4.4 million years old, right, Lucy? So 4.4 million years. Where was the first you? Who you think you were? Think you were Asian? You think you were white? You think you were African? What do you think you were? Mongolian? What do you think you were? The first you, say 4.4 million years ago, the first male, your sperm. What do you think you were? Where do you think you were at?
I mean,
they say Africa.
They say Africa, yeah.
But then they found out there's a country under Turkey that's 9,000 years old.
Yeah, so I have no idea.
Now they got to rewrite history. What do we know? How do you rewrite history when you find something, a problem like that? I don't know.
No idea.
We don't know anything. We know what somebody told you. You don't even know how old you are. You're 51 because Julius Caesar said you're 51. Julius Caesar said, I'm 53, so I'm 53. He said I was born in 1966 A.D., so that's when I was born. Now, I didn't get no information from nowhere. I didn't do no research. But the research I did find out that this guy told me how old I was. Mm-hmm. So I don't know anything about myself. That what I do know, that I went to prison, I did this, I became champ, I work here, I do this stuff. And that. But that's what I know. But after that, I don't know anything about, nothing about me. I don't know if I'm from another planet and we were planted here. I don't know anything. What do you know?
Less than I thought. You know, I mean, I know.
Everybody's trying to figure out the world. What's the key? What's the magic key? Mm-hmm. And somebody told me, especially for black people, he said, the answer is so simple, but for black people, it has to be complicated. It has to be real complex to be the answer. Mm-hmm. If it's right in front of you, it can't be the answer. Mm-hmm. The answer to everything is really so easy. But just because it's so easy, we can never figure it out. Because we're so intellectual, it has to be some apex intellectual stuff that we can't pronounce, like Nietzsche or something.
Whatever. Yeah. Carl Jung.
Yeah,
man. I'm glad to meet you guys. I mean, I think you're doing something.
What'd you write, Van?
I wrote down bipartisan because I wanted to make sure to underscore that Republicans are doing some good things. Mm. I feel like, you know, so polarized.
Yeah.
That you know, we almost don't want to give the other side credit when they're right.
Yeah.
Now look, when they're wrong, and listen, this is a lot of stuff we just not going to agree about.
Right.
And that's in a democracy. Where you disagree, you're supposed to fight. In democracy, you're not supposed to agree. Dictatorship, you have to agree. Democracy means you can have your opinion, you can have yours, you can have yours. But when we disagree, we're supposed to fight. But where we do agree, we're supposed to work together. And we stopped doing that. So I always try to remind myself to point that out. And then I wrote down my son. I wanted to make sure to give him some credit.
How can anybody work with a dictator? I don't think there should ever be a dictator. I should think that should be illegal.
Agree.
No one should be a dictator.
Well, in our country, it is illegal.
But still we have, well, still listen. Napoleon said this to his mother. There'll always be kings, even if they go by different names. And that's what it is. Trump is running this country like he's a king. Yeah. You know, and that's just what it is. He feels like a king.
Yeah.
And people treat him like a king. So he lives like a king. And people love it. Because everybody wants to be a king in their sick mind. You know?
Yeah. Well, he's...
Anybody think they're a king in their own world, believe it or not. You know what I mean? Even though my wife is the boss of my house, I believe I'm a king. I believe I'm the king. I have the title.
Yeah, that's a great quote by Napoleon. Van, what do you see? I mean, I know criminal justice reform is going to be huge in this coming election.
Mm-hmm.
I have a real problem with, I mean, you tell me, you know better than me, but why is Joe Biden still up there?
They want him to be. He's going to be the guy to go against Trump. That's a definite, because he's going against Trump. Listen, he could start farting in the debate and still go against Trump, because that's where it is. It's written in stone that he's going to be one to face off against Trump.
The Democratic Party just
right?
loses sure. my faith.
Van, isn't that
more
true?
And more
basically,
all the time.
That's the guy that's going to face Trump.
I don't know if it's true. I know the establishment really wants it to be Biden. And,
that's what I'm talking about, the establishment, yeah.
Fuck this guy, man. Sorry, get him out.
Why? What do you say?
Well, first of all, from a criminal justice perspective, wasn't he part of, was it the Clinton bill?
He did the 94 crime bill in the Senate.
Yes, exactly.
He was just following orders. Horrible. He was just following orders.
Second of all, he seems incredibly out of touch and very creepy. And just not a guy that I'm interested in having as my leader. Our leaders should be fucking passionate. That's why we have Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say what you will. When I read that about you working with him and him working to get 7,000, signing a bill to get 7,000 people and more, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah, more over time.
That was huge.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it didn't necessarily clean the slate for me on Trump at all, but, you know, that says a lot. Yeah. About the direction of
that
things.
That says a lot, too, but I just keep thinking, my frame of mind, because I was one of those guys before, and I've been in there with those guys, they're letting out damaged people.
Well, but I do see it differently because, yes, there are some people who come home with kind of, you know, who've had challenges, but usually my experience has been the majority of people who are coming home, they really want to land on their feet and do well and we've got to do a better job of giving them a place to
land. I'm from Brownsville, Brooklyn, okay?
Yeah.
And this is what I know. What is it they call the return rate, recidivism rate? What
Very high, 67%.
Yeah, from Brownsville, Brooklyn, man, it must be 80%, if not more. Mm-hmm. Everybody I know that's been locked up has been repeat offenders. Me, all my friends. They're all in jail now or dead or strung out on drugs. Very few of them I see from Brownsville.
So you're saying that we need to make sure that there's a program when they come home, they can land on their feet. You're not saying leave them in there forever. You're saying when they come home,
they need a program.
Well, I mean,
I'm just a strong believer because it helped me. I just know it helps.
Yeah.
I know
what helped you? Yeah, yeah.
A program.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
what types of things?
Like an Outlook program. You have to go, before you find a job, you have to get a skill for the job. You have to be able to have almost like hospitality skills to take care of yourself in the workplace.
I think we should spend a lot more time. First of all, I think we should put a lot.
Getting along with workers. You know, you're coming out of prison talking to people crazy. Mm-hmm. Now you got to go in the workplace. What did you say? You have to be very careful after talking to somebody. What you say to somebody that did 20 years in prison. Mm-hmm. It's all about respecting how they talk to. It's just a different world.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't say, hey, fuck off, all right, dude?
Yeah.
It's just different. That's to them, that's the biggest disrespect. He told me to fuck off?
Right.
You know, you got to change that mindset before we get in the workplace.
Yeah.
I think as much time and energy as we spent building up these prisons, we're locking people up. You know, $140,000 per year per young person locked up. You could send two kids to Yale.
Crazy.
It's a racket.
It's a racket. So
it's crazy.
What I would say is now take that same amount of energy, keep that same energy. Put fewer people in, make sure when they come home, they do have those kind of programs and we'll be all right. The problem is that we spend so much time and energy damaging people and then we don't want to spend any money when they come home.
This is what we do. These guys that we're in prison, they're making these places, they're making these things in these prisons. The people who they're making them for, they should make it possible. So when these guys get out, after making all that money for our company, they should be able to be civilized. I don't know the proper word to say, but
they say rehabilitated, transform, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
Because listen, man, I know what they do behind it, and all of a sudden you go let these guys out.
I say bring them home and keep that same energy to make sure they come home the right way. That's what I say.
Oh, absolutely, bring them home. But what you gonna bring them home to? Yeah. That's gonna be. What are you gonna do if you let a lion out of the cage after 20 years and you just let him go in the population?
Like I said, you and I agree that the way people come home should matter, and we should from the moment somebody goes in, and you know, I wish that fewer people would go in. We should be thinking about that day they come home, and every single day should be supported. Right now, nobody makes money when the people go home and do well. They make money when people come back, return customers. Yes. And what we've got to do, we got to change the financial incentive. I want a warden to be rewarded. I would say, listen, of all these 5-6 people, if they leave on Friday and they come back on Monday with their best friends, you're fired. If they leave on Friday and they stay gone for 3 years and they've been productive, we should give you $1 million because you just saved us so much money. In other words, you should get a reward for every person who leaves your prison and does a good job. Now, every day you're in my prison, I'm doing yoga with you.
Right.
I'm teaching you
meditation.
How to read. You know what I mean? Because that's money coming back into my pocket. There's no financial incentive to make people do a good job.
That's America. I looked at a few years ago. I watched this program about students. Like you say in Germany, you're a young kid, 16, 15, fuck school. I don't want to go to school, right? I want to smoke weed. Not the police. The government takes you. And we train you to work on our BMWs and our Mercedes-Benz and work with the... Everything. You only got to go to school for 3 hours here. You got to go to class.
Vocational training.
But you got to work on our computers and stuff on the cars. Mm. And so this guy is working on our cars, and now he has a job. He doesn't like school. You don't like school, we'll give you a job here.
Yeah.
And they give you enough school so you can graduate from high school and you keep your job here.
And then you're not out there causing
But
havoc.
You're working.
Right.
You don't like school. You're playing hooky. Oh, I'll take care of you. Hey, you do it. In Japan, for instance, great student. The business, you know, what's the radio companies and stuff from Japan?
Like Sony.
Sony, Kiyoshi, all those places.
Yeah.
They make deals with the school. If you give me 200,000 good workers, I promise them jobs. Mm. In America, if you don't make it, it's on you.
Yeah.
When you're born, if you don't do nothing,
you're a fuck up.
Money, it's on you. You fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the government and the school system work together.
Yeah,
the business, the business and the government work together.
Yeah, there are a lot of better ways. If you see every kid as your kid, you have a totally different system than if you say, oh, well, those kids, their kids. Nobody says, oh, my kid's on drugs. Give them 17 years in prison. Nobody's ever said that about their own kid.
Right.
But your kid, give them 50 years. And so that's, you know, that's a spiritual crisis. That's a you know, the humanizing the opposite of.
They don't see no hope in us.
Yeah.
And by our government not seeing hope in us, we don't see hope in ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So they don't see a better hope in life. You know what I mean? So they're desperate. I don't see a better hope. Why the hell I got to go to school? Why I got to listen to my mother? Why I'm going to die anyway? They killed my father. They killed my brother. How am I going to survive?
Vin, how do you feel about the MORE Act? Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act of 2019.
Look, I'm all for it. Look, I'm a nerd. I've never had a beer. I've never smoked marijuana. I've never.
You're an interesting guy, man. I know a couple of guys like you. I couldn't imagine living without that stuff.
I've never had a sip of champagne. I've never had a sip of wine. Never, none. So I can say, as a complete nerd, anti-drug nerd, that I'm against the drug war because it doesn't work, and it's never been prosecuted. Look, there's more drugs at a country club, yacht club, Ivy League school. Ask me how I know. I know. I've been to all those places. Way more drugs in those contexts than on a street corner in the hood. So now that they're making it legal, marijuana, every single person who is convicted of that, it should just be wiped off their record.
Yeah.
And all the money coming in, the tax money, should be going back to those communities, back to those individuals, and helping them get on their feet. And otherwise, it's just another situation where black people created a market, white people come and exploit it.
Mm.
When we did it, it was illegal. They do it now, it's legal.
Mm. When we did rap music in the street, the cops came and shut us down.
Yeah.
Now the cops come to stop the people from breaking in the stores and stealing it.
Yeah, I mean,
ain't that a trip?
Yeah, but I mean, I've seen it my whole life. You know, I got a chance to work with Prince. I did all of his philanthropic work for about 6 years.
What was that like?
Yeah. Yeah. Prince, that's dope.
He's a very interesting guy. I met him a couple of times. He's very interesting.
Yeah. No, I mean, he saved my life, man, because, you know, when I worked for Obama, I only worked there for about 6 months, and then the right-wing media came after me because I was like young militant and stuff, and they're bringing back all the stuff from when I was younger. So, and then also making up stuff.
Tell me some stuff about you when you were younger. What did you do to make them think you were a militant?
I was a Marxist. I was suing cops. I was protesting everything I could. I was every ist I could find that was against the system. Nationalist, Marxist, anarchist, any ist. Because I was pissed off. Look, man, if you're in your early 20s, I mean, we were the same age. I mean, you know, I mean, we in the 80s, you know, that's when Public Enemy and Spike Lee and N.W.A. Absolutely. Came out. So they had put it in our mind that we need to stand up for ourselves. And then we get in the 90s, we finally get rid of Reagan and Bush. We got Clinton, and Clinton's worse.
Mm.
And he's dropping all these terrible, you know, bills against us. And
he has us brainwashed. Clinton has more black people brainwashed than liquor, man.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah.
But I mean, Biden as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, all that whole sick clique, all of them. Look, I appreciated Bill Clinton more after he was president when he was doing. He doesn't get credit for afterwards. See, when he was doing the Clinton Global Initiative and raising millions of dollars and helping people around the world, but when he was president, he was weak on affirmative action, weak on welfare, weak on anything black, weak on criminal justice. And so I was mad, and I felt like my parents had lied to me, you know. My dad had been in the military, and you know, liberty and justice for all, and all this type of stuff. And I'm like, I'm at this law school, and I can look down this street to the university and see kids buck wild who are going to be senators, and I can look down this street in New Haven to housing project and kids who are doing less bad stuff who are all going to be in prison. And so I'm like, my dad lied to me. This whole system lied to me. So. I was on the left side of Pluto. I was considered a left wing radical.
But your father didn't lie to you. He was just told you information he was fed.
Right, exactly. He was just passing it along. But you know, so you know, when I was in, I was considered a left wing radical in the Bay Area. You have to work hard to be considered a left wing radical in San Francisco and Berkeley and Oakland. But
that's where that stuff came from.
Yeah, exactly. So I was in all of that in my 20s. When I got to my 30s, I burned out because it was just too many protests, too many funerals. with you know, community kids and who I work with or who I cared about in caskets, and grown people with gray hair sitting up in the pews, like the opposite of how it's supposed to be. And we're just banging our heads against the wall, and I couldn't see how we could make a difference. So I burned out, and I decided to try and do something more positive for the community, bringing jobs. And we had just passed all of these solar bills and stuff in California. So I said, why don't we get these kids on the street corner jobs putting up the solar panels? Solar panels don't put themselves up. And these people are ordering all these solar panels, and they're taking 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, because nobody knows how to put them up. So I got the city of Oakland to start a program called the Green Jobs Corps to train these kids to put up solar panels. Nancy Pelosi found out about it. She had just become Speaker of the House the first time. She said, bring Van Jones to Washington, D.C. I was a nobody. I was a local activist to talk to all of my Democratic Congress members about this idea. George W. Bush then signs a bill called the Green Jobs Act to spread my little program in Oakland all across the country. That's 2007. 2008, I wrote a book about it. The book became a bestseller. People on Barack Obama's team read the book. 2009, I'm in the White House. So I go from being a frontline grassroots activist in like a two-year period to being in the White House. So when the right-wing media figured, I said, wait a second, this dude, Mr. F the Police, Mr. Suing Cops, Mr. you know, down with the system, is now in the White House? No, this is not going to work. So then I said, Prince saved my life, because when I left the Obama White House, he picked me up.
How do you perceive that? You perceive that all from your hard work? Do you think that happened because you work hard?
Well, what do you think?
No, I just want to know what you think. Do you think that happened because you were grinding, working hard?
It felt like all of a sudden I was like walking down the street, and I put my foot down on what I thought was the asphalt, and it was like a magic carpet, and it just took off. And all of a sudden I'm in places I've never been. I'm seeing people I would never thought I would meet. I don't know.
I know what this is now. You're in your 50s now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's your mission. Figure out all this stuff. Why is this shit going on? It's not going to stop. You got to figure it out. Why is this going on? I'm thinking that too, right? I'm thinking this. I came in here a few years ago. They decided to make this show. I thought this is a fucking joke. I'm going to be an asshole. I'll be a fuck yeah. And then so we get a guest that's was he a shaman?
Shaman, yeah.
A shaman. I don't know what a shaman is. That sounds Jewish to me. Right? So I'm just checking him out. So he's talking about this toad and this venom and stuff. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Let me see this shit. And he said, well, you can't do it right here. I said, what kind of shit you talking about? You can't do it because I'm used to doing drugs. Oh, smoke, sniff, whatever. It's right here. And so he said, we have to wait till he said, Mike, wait till the show. And he likes to stay in a crack pipe. He's like some toad venom. I smoke it because I'm a fucking drug a fucking aficionado, and I smoke, and it goes out, and I die. And I just die, and it was the most profound moment of my life. There's never been in my life, not even my children, there's never been nothing that profound. The experience that I've seen or felt. And I've did it 9 times since then. And this one particular time, it just felt like I felt all the pain that I caused everybody that I've experienced in my life. Caused pain. I felt the pain. It was humiliating. I thought I'm a tough guy. I think I'm a bad motherfucker. I saw the God of War, and I fucking disintegrated in his presence. I was nothing. I never looked at people the same. I treated them the same ever since. And then that's the closest I've ever felt to experience anything divinely or godly. And every time you do it, it's a different experience. It's not like you get prepared for it. It's always taking you somewhere else.
I feel that I have a calling on my life. I feel.
That's what I wanted to get in touch with. I wanted you to get in touch with that calling. Why do you feel you had that calling? Who gave you that calling?
You
had to see somebody.
I remember being a child, and I would always want to go in the backyard at night and lie down on my back and look up at the stars. Like I said, we didn't have streetlights, so you could see literally every star. And I'd be out there, and my mom would, I could see her opening that glass door, you know, like a back door, and she'd be like, Anthony, because my name is Anthony, get in this house. And I would say, well, I'm praying, Mom. She goes, you can pray in your bed, get in this house. But there was just something I just felt, and I was probably like 6, 7, I just felt the presence of God. I felt that was something I was supposed to do. I felt when I was a child, they would show us, Bobby Kennedy and Dr. King and these guys, and you forget, like, now they've been dead for so long, it's like not that big of a deal. But if you're born in 68, that's the year they were killed. So when you're in kindergarten, that's just 5 years ago. Now imagine if somebody killed Obama right now, a child that was born that year. 5 years later, they don't know. So I remember this kid named Patrick Carmody in my kindergarten class asked my teacher, Miss Brown, who was Bobby Kennedy? And she started crying like a baby. And I'd never seen an adult cry. I didn't even really know that adults could cry, you know, because they were so, you stop crying. So, and I was like, whoa. And I asked my mom, and she was stumbling around her words and stuff. And I just felt, again, that these guys died the year I was born. Bobby Kennedy was trying to do something positive. Dr. King was trying to do something positive. For some reason, it felt like I was supposed to take up their cause. But it's not rational, because other kids heard the same thing, read the same thing, and they didn't do what I was doing. So all I can say is that my whole life, I never had to guess what I was going to do. I always knew I was going to work for justice, help people, you know, write and fight. That was the two things I wanted to do. I was too nerdy to fight, but in my mind, I was preparing. So I feel like there's a calling on my life. I feel almost now, like I said, I have nothing else to prove. I've gotten 4 presents in a row to do something positive that I believed in. And the world is in shambles, and all this stuff is happening, all this polarization. I don't care what the Republicans or Democrats think. I don't care what white or black think. I just want, that's where I'm stuck. There's a prayer that's trying to come through me that I've got to get myself completely cleaned out and able to channel so I can really find out what God wants for me to do going forward.
I can dig that. Mm. I can dig that.
Well, Van, you're the man, dude.
Thank you, fucking man.
Thank you for coming here.
Well, I appreciate it, man. I appreciate the opportunity, and, you know, and have me back. And like I said, I'm literally at a spiritual crossroads, and I'm praying for God to give me my next set of directions and orders. And you know, this has been powerful. I mean,
well, you just met Mike, so that's the first step.
Television too. My mother-in-law was saying, "Oh, he's so awesome."
I always love your perspective, man.
Yeah,
because corporate media sucks. I have to say,
it's not public radio, or, you know, the stuff I love. Still, what I love, Sesame Street. I love
no doubt.
You know, I love Mr. Rogers. I love Electric Company, because TV was
remember
like
we see Morgan Freeman on Electric Company back.
Yeah,
in the
exactly. Back in the day, you know what I mean? That stuff was
Skinny
awesome.
Morgan Freeman.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But you think about it, because TV when we were growing up was like a wasteland of like cartoon violence and cowboys shooting up and stuff. Yeah. And they had these couple of
Popeye,
shows.
Popeye, Bluto. And
yeah, just smashing
many fam.
Yeah, and everything. Yeah. It's like it was all violent and crazy. And then they had a couple of shows. They said, "No, we're going to use television for good."
Yeah.
And that's in my heart. I want to use TV for good. And so I appreciate CNN. They let the Van Jones Show, they call it Sesame Street for grown people. Like, I try to bring people together. They let me do the Redemption Project, where I was showing people coming together who, you know, one had committed a crime, the other would have been the victim. We brought them together. Incarceration Incorporated podcast they let me do. So CNN keeps letting me do
that's
positive
awesome.
Stuff.
It's great.
But it's tough, because it's, you know, it's a very, very negative media environment right now. And We got to keep our candle lit for good.
Yeah,
we got to keep our candle lit. So
we'll keep doing it, man.
Hey, brother. Thank
you. Keep spreading the truth.
Thank you, brother.
Keep spreading your message.
This is so awesome.
Yeah, man.
You got
thank
our
you.
Support, very, very, man. Very, any hey. Way that we can support you
oh, no,
and
I'm
everything
ask.
You're
don't
doing.
Worry. Oh, hey, listen. When it's time to fight, I call on all forces.
Awesome. Tell the people what they can do, where they can find you at, and what you
that's good.
Need for them to do.
Yes, yeah, listen. ReformAlliance.com. Just you can go there. You can sign up. You can be a part of what we're doing. I'm proud to be a part of the Cut 50 movement. CUT50.org is also a great organization. But the main thing is, in your own life, if you can give a job to somebody, consider somebody who's formerly incarcerated. Consider somebody who's, you know, from a tough neighborhood. If you've got a school that you're running or a program, include people. Just because somebody did something and got caught that you probably did when you were in college, don't leave them out.
Love it, man. Thank you again.
So what are you saying? What the world needs more now is love, sweet love, huh?
Amen.
Yeah, I agree.
Amen to that.
Amen.
Mike.
Yes.
Great show, bro.
Brilliant show.
Beautiful. Beautiful Amen. Episode. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this special episode of Hot Boxing.
Yes, and I have my mother-in-law right here because she came to see the Van Jones show. Say hi to the people out there, Ma.
Hi.
There's millions of people looking at you, Ma, right now. Millions of people.
I love that.
They got good genes in that family.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Good genes. Good people.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, until next time, everybody, I'm Eben Britton.
And I'm Mike Tyson.
We're out of here.
See ya.